This is the English Heritage Podcast.
Hello, and thanks for joining us for your weekly podcast, Into England's Past. I'm Charles Rowe. Today we're looking at the vital role that Charles Darwin's home and garden in Kent played in developing his theory of evolution by natural selection. Much of his Down House estate was a living laboratory for him to do experiments, which were arguably just as important as his observations on his Beagle voyage. And soon you'll be able to find out more about this work as part of new interactive displays for visitors. So, talking us through Darwin's experiments and English Heritage's new visitor offer are...
Emily Parker, I'm Landscape Advisor at English Heritage, which involves doing research on the gardens and landscape in the care of English Heritage.
And I'm Nadine Langford, and I'm an Interpretation Manager, which means that I work with historians and advisors like Emily and designers to bring the stories of our sites to life for visitors.
We'll start off with Emily. In order to help us understand just how much time went into Darwin's world-changing book on the origin of species, could you explain when Darwin first left on his Beagle voyage and when his book was finally published?
Yeah, so Darwin left on his voyage in 1831 and he returned 5 years later in 1836. But his book, The Origin of the Species, wasn't published until 1859. So that's nearly 30 years after he set out. But he did a lot of thinking and theorising in that time. It wasn't a sort of static time. It was when he was building up this idea that he was going to publish. And it was time well spent because he put a lot of thought into this final work. However, he didn't want to publish then. That wasn't his intention. But he got hold of the idea that a colleague of his was about to publish on a similar vein, and they decided to present a paper together in order to make sure that they both got due credit for their work in this area. And then obviously Darwin followed that up with his On the Origin of Species book, which has become the sort of foundation for this kind of science.
And he also did some shorter publications in the meantime, within that sort of long 30-year thinking period, didn't he?
He did, and they were mainly very closely related to his journeys on the Beagle, about things that he'd seen on his voyages, rather than being based on any of the new observations and experiments he was undertaking at Down House. And these new experiments obviously fed into the On the Origin of Species.
Down House, of course, was a place for experimentation for Charles Darwin. The Darwins moved to the property in Kent as their family was starting to grow, I understand. Can you give us a bit more background on why they chose to move to this particular property?
So they moved to Down House in 1842, and it was, as you say, mainly about room for expansion and to grow as they had an ever-increasing family. And they wanted sort of some land and the neighbours who were neither too near or too far, as they put it. It was mainly for the benefit of the children, somewhere for them to be liberated from their crowded London house. But it was still close enough to London that Darwin could get in if he wanted to go and hear papers being read or similar things in the London hubbub, that far enough away that he could concentrate on his work.
It's almost commutable distance in today's modern parlance there.
Yeah, then not as commutable as it is today, because it would have taken quite a long time. The nearest railway station was still quite a long way from Down at that time.
But that space, all that land, was very important, obviously. What did the garden itself mean to Darwin?
So the garden was a space for Darwin to experiment and sort of test his ideas. It was not just the garden, it was the wider landscape and countryside surrounding Down House as well. And these were areas where he could go and test his ideas, look at things in detail, and find lots of different habitats and things to look at. The sandwalk, which is an area which is a small copse of woodland, which is just on this like edge of his garden, also became like a what we call like a thinking path for Darwin. It was an area where he could walk around. He used to do it a couple of times each day, and he used to have a think about what he was thinking about for his works and contemplate all the scientific theories he was coming up with.
They do say that if you go for a walk, if you're working on a project or something, that can help sort of keep the ideas flowing, and then you can come back to your desk sort of refreshed, can't you?
Yeah, they do say that. I mean, one of the problems that Darwin had was that he would mark each time he walked around this loop with a stone. So he'd put a stone down marker to show how many times he'd walked around that loop. But his children would come along and kick those stones out of the way, so he wouldn't know how many times he'd walked it. So perhaps it was a little bit trickier for him to keep up those ideas.
Yes, as we've mentioned in a previous podcast. But he was doing experiments in the garden, as well as obviously having that thinking time along the sand walk. why was he doing experiments in the garden?
So the garden was, as we said a lot of times, his sort of living laboratory. So this is where he could conduct hundreds of experiments on the natural world. And he did do lots and lots of different, very specific and meticulous experiments, some of which that led to ideas and theories, and some of which never became anything particularly interesting. And his theory of natural selection had two sort of main strands. So he wanted to gain an idea about how plants and animals changed and adapted to their environments over a long course of time. He also wanted to show how the struggle of existence among all living things, so how the sort of fittest survived and passed on any advantageous traits to the next generation. And for these sort of theories to work, he also had to prove that the world is much older than was believed at the time. And he found ways of doing experiments on all of these things in different ways in the garden at Down House.
Okay, well, let's look at some of the examples of experiments that he did and where they took place in the garden. I gather that, first of all, there was a weeds experiment. Where was that?
Yeah, so literally, as you come out of the shop today, or out of sort of the back door of Down House, there's this area on the lawns which has been completely cleared of grass. And in that area, Darwin just left it to see what weeds would come up. And each time a weed came up in this sort of bare patch of earth, he would mark it with a little wire marker. And then he came back over, I think it's about 3 months, to see how many weeds survived. And not many did. I think it was sort of 20% survived or something, so a very small proportion. And the rest had been sort of either killed by drought or sort of eaten by slugs or snails. And he used this as an example of how there's this competition in like struggle for existence in life everywhere, even in that tiny patch of soil. And that's an experiment you can still see today as it's replicated by our garden team.
Okay, so that's the weeds one. There's a few other experiments of note. One relates to primroses.
Yeah, so in 1850s, Darwin sort of took over a corner of the kitchen garden to do some different experiments with different types of plants. So one of these was with primroses. And what he had seen, which other people had spotted before, but which he developed into understanding why this might be, was that primroses had two distinct types of flower form. And these kind of became sort of what we would call today, and he used this analogy, sort of male and female parts of plants. So a male version and a female version. And obviously this means that they would, when they were pollinating and cross-pollinating, this caused them to cross-pollinate rather than self-pollinate. And it gave an advantage to different insects in order to create this. And that gives the primroses what we would call today sort of new genetic diversity, e.g. it swaps the pollen between the two plants, creating different small adaptations that gradually over time could change into adapting to different environments.
Right. So cross-pollination, he effectively cemented some ideas around that.
Yeah. And the ideas of why you would want to cause cross-pollination to create different diversity and be able to adapt over long periods was Darwin's key idea.
A third interesting experiment that Darwin did at Down House related to worms, didn't it?
Yeah, Darwin was fascinated by worms, and even his sort of final work, big publication, was on the action of earthworms. So he'd been thinking about worms for the last 50 years. And the reason he was interested in worms was about how they moved soil and what they could tell you about how old the earth was. So one experiment he did in the meadow at Down House was to lay down some sort of cinders and soot on the top of the surface, which obviously would be like sort of whitey grey colour. And he put this on the surface of the meadow, and then he would wait and see how far that would get buried. And the reason that it was buried was because earthworms would bring up their casts and place them on top of the soil. And eventually that would bury the cinders below the soil. And his argument was that this proved that the earth must be much older than it was because of how deep things became buried. So for example, he was interested in how Roman villas and their floors, mosaics, how far buried they could get over time. And that could show you how much the action of earthworms was showing how much things became buried. And this was all feeding up to his ideas about how old the earth was, which is what, as we discussed earlier, was key to getting some of his ideas agreed by other scientists.
Yeah, that's a really fascinating idea, isn't it? With this idea that eventually the soil builds up and then you have to dig for history in a way.
Yeah, and one of his examples he used was that he said, one day Stonehenge could be completely buried. Mm-hmm. You know, that was one of his key examples. So, you know, that's a nice bit of sort of bringing the two sides of what English Heritage does together, which is Darwin's ideas and also the idea of these sort of buried monuments that have been discovered by archaeology at our sites.
Absolutely. It brings together his science, biology, the natural world, with history and even archaeology, which is fascinating, really. So I suppose English Heritage owe a debt of gratitude to the work that he did. So these experiments, they sound so basic to us now and very simple observations. But this was really, really new science at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, they sound really simple, but I think this is quite deceptive, as they were actually very clever and sort of meticulously planned by Darwin, whereas he was building up this sort of patchwork of ideas. And he was recording everything and like putting it together in a kind of much grander and bigger scheme, which is what we see in his published works. And his work was sort of revolutionary. This idea of sort of, particularly as a sort of gentleman, doing this kind of hands-on experimentation and detailed, meticulous research that he would then draw together and publish was very revolutionary at the time. And obviously his ideas are revolutionary too, but the idea of the experimenting and the ideas together was what makes Darwin so special.
And of course, it sort of upturns the religious ideas at the time as well. It was really starting to challenge the idea of creation and all that sort of thing, wasn't it? And Genesis. How did Darwin use these experiments to support his theories?
So he used them, as I said before, as a kind of bringing together of ideas. Each of the individual experiments was just sort of a building block to pull it together as into one big picture. It was the careful observations, and he recorded everything in his experiment books, and then he used them as examples to support wider theories and ideas. So it was very much sort of the experiments were kind of the bedrock of what he kind of extrapolated from to create these much wider theories, which is what he's famous for today.
So it was almost as if from each experiment there was a new mark, like an artist doing a sketch, and he'd keep coming back to the picture and draw another mark with a new experiment, and then eventually the picture would start becoming more of a sketch that you would recognise, and then it becomes almost a full-blown colour picture.
And I think the thing that's interesting about Darwin is that he's working over such a long period of time. So he starts things in sort of the 1840s or 1850s, and then doesn't come back to develop them until sort of 20 years later. So he's always, as you say, sort of sketching the framework of what he's doing and then colouring in different bits and then coming back to it and colouring in another, painting in another bit, till eventually he kind of forms this overall theory, which is that finished picture. But he wouldn't have said it was finished. He felt like he was still proving and trying to find evidence for his theory all of his life. And that was something that he continued to work on.
Well, that's science in a nutshell, isn't it? It's always evolving. Now, I also gather that Charles Darwin used his children to help him with his experiments. We did cover this on a previous podcast, if people haven't heard that already. But what sort of things did he get his children to do?
So Charles and his wife Emma had 10 children, although sadly not all of them survived into adulthood. And he often involved all of them with his experiments. So for example, Henrietta helped him look after the pigeons. So she was helping him sort of feed them and manage them and look after them. His son George was fascinated by bumblebees and how they moved from place to place. So one experiment that Darwin did using all of his children was something that we call his buzzing places experiment, where he dusted bees with flour and then he made his children stand at certain points along the garden to chase where that particular bumblebee went. And he found that they all went to particular places. So they all sort of followed the same route and all stopped at same trees or whatever. He couldn't work out why, and that was one of his great unsolved sort of experiments, was why those bees all followed the same route. And he covered it over several years, and why the bees always went to the same ones, even if they were different generation of bees.
And do we even know the answer today? Is it still a mystery?
No, so the answer was solved eventually by sort of modern science, which is that they were giving out these sort of pheromones, so these kind of like unseen sort of
scents
that they could then be picked up by bees over succeeding generations.
Oh, I see. That's fascinating.
And that's how bees navigate. That's how they know where their hive is.
Right. I've got these images in my head of children chasing after bees.
And they did. And one of them, I can't remember which one it was, like was ended up chasing through some like undergrowth and having to like, you know, dive into these sort of thickets of undergrowth trying to chase these bees. So yeah, I mean, it must be quite a funny sight.
I suppose that's one way of doing it, isn't it? What's your favourite Darwin experiment? I think that one sounds like it's my favourite already, but do you have a favourite one?
I think one of my favourite ones was that he was really interested in how seeds could travel and end up in different parts of the world. And this was to prove his ideas about why different plants end up with different adaptations in different areas. So how he did this was he soaked lots of different seeds, and I'm talking sort of hundreds of different types of seeds, in water, seawater, to see if they would survive. He meticulously recorded all this, and we've got his notebooks, and it shows asparagus survives 12 days in seawater. So he's kind of experimenting how far they could travel in the ocean and still germinate and still survive. But what I find particularly endearing, perhaps, about Darwin was that he suddenly realised that they need to be able to float in order to also do this. So he'd done all the experiments on seawater, but then he realised that if they can't float to get to a certain place and they just sink in the ocean, then all of his experiments are for nothing. So then he starts on a whole round of testing how the seeds float. And he does a huge amount of experiments on, as this testing all the same ones again, on how long they float in seawater. And he found those really discouraging because not many of them did float. And then he tried how, if they were dried, if they'd float better. And then he came up with some like theories and ideas of how they could still travel. For example, could they end up on wood or plants or trees and like sort of float on those, the seeds float on those trees to get to different places? So it sort of opened up a whole world of ideas for him about how he could understand how different seeds and plants spread around the globe.
And am I right in saying that he theorised that potentially seed ingested by birds who then died could then end up in another part of, I don't know, a country, or through the bird dying and then being passed down a river, etc.?
Yeah, so this was his son Francis's idea. It just kind of shows the kind of depths that Darwin went to, in that his son Francis came up with this idea. So they decided to test it. He wanted to let his son have a go at seeing if that would work. So they had a pigeon, I think it was a pigeon they used, and they had some, it swallowed some seed, and then the pigeon died. I don't know how the pigeon died, let's not think about that too much. And then they floated it in seawater to see how long, if that seed would still germinate after sort of 10 days or something. So I think it just shows Darwin's sort of willingness to kind of try everything, to kind of look at that, how things could work, and then to investigate whether that was possible.
In order to do these experiments, it wasn't just Darwin himself and his children. I gather that he did some letter writing to ask questions of other people as well, and he was gathering information from other sources. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so Darwin wasn't working in a vacuum. He was talking to lots of other scientists, and he even wrote to gardening magazines asking for anyone to write back to him about their experience in certain topics and to get advice to help on his experiments. So one of the magazines he wrote to quite often was the Gardener's Chronicle, which is, yes, a very famous gardening magazine. And he wrote to them on topics such as, do seeds survive salt water? And he also asked for help with his experiments he was doing on hollyhocks and inheritance, writing to them and asking, can anyone tell me what happens if you plant these hollyhocks next to each other? Or can anyone who's an expert in hollyhocks write to me and ask, talk to me about what they found? So he was using sort of a very wide pool of resource to sort of get sort of other people's expertise to help him gather evidence, because as much as he was doing lots of experiments in his garden, he hadn't got the scope to do the sort of breadth of experiments he needed, so he was calling on other people to provide evidence for him as well.
Did he do experiments in the kitchen garden as well, at the back of the property? This is the walled garden area, which people might know if they visited. Was a kitchen garden important to his experiments, as well as obviously being a place to grow produce and keep the family fed?
Yeah, so he took over part of that fruit and veg garden. I don't know what Emma Darwin thought about this, but he took over part of it as an experimental science bed, essentially. So he used these experimental beds to sort of grow his hollyhocks, grow his primroses, and he could look at them in a kind of confined space and compare and observe them. So that was very much important to how his experiments came about.
Okay, well, let's bring Nadine into the conversation now. Nadine is our interpretation manager. You've been developing this new visitor experience that is being introduced at Down House. Can you tell us why it was important to do the project, and also just tell us a bit more about what people will see?
Absolutely. Well, Emily's outlined the amazing things that went on in the garden, but we really wanted to get across the fact that this domestic garden in a leafy part of Kent completely changed our understanding of the world, and there's an internationally significant space that shows that you can discover things that change the course of history in a back garden, essentially. And we wanted to bring that to our visitors.
Until now, then, we haven't had anything really much in the garden that visitors can see that tell us about what Emily has been explaining. But now visitors will be able to see some displays. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So what we've done is introduced moments in the garden where Darwin was working on these experiments. So Emily was talking about the weed garden, which is still something that the kind of gardeners keep up as a rolling live scientific project. So we have introduced a way to kind of tell that story for visitors. And we've layered it in a way that gives you an oversight, a deeper dive into what Darwin was looking for, but then also a kind of playful and hands-on interactive moment where you can spin some drums and see how many of your seeds survive against some munching slugs, and another moment where very young children can get involved and play. And so we've made this one-stop shop for our family visitors to really dig into what Darwin was trying to do at Down and also have some fun together. And we're hoping that it really will sort of spark conversations between our visitors and get them to think about their own gardens and what those slugs are up to when they're munching your precious seedlings. And we kind of introduced 5 of these moments in the garden, so relating to some of the other things that Emily's been talking about. And we've kind of spread them across the things that Darwin was trying to investigate in his theory of natural selection, which, Emily, you're going to have to help me again.
So the 5 are, let me just try to remember this. So there's the weed garden. There's the wormstone, which is about Darwin's experiments with worms. There's one on clover, which is about Darwin's experiments with how food chains work today. There's one which is about hollyhocks, which is about inheritance. And there's the final one, which is on the primroses and primulas, which is about how plants adapt and change over time.
Okay, so there's 5 different places in the garden landscape where visitors will come across an area. They'll be able to see this sort of reference to the experiment that took place there. Then they can maybe move on to another area of the garden where they'll see something else explained, etc. Is it all displayed via panels, or how will people see it?
We've worked with a design company to create a post which does all the work for us. So it's enabled us to integrate our storytelling with our interactivity. And obviously they have to be kind of super robust and weatherproof, but they are a mixture of clay and the stories. So there's 5 in the garden. And then behind the glasshouse in Down, for those that have perhaps been before his famous glasshouse, there's a space that's called the lab. And in there, we've got a bit more of this contextual story of what Darwin was trying to unpack with his experiments, and then further hands-on interpretation, looking at some of the other experiments that Darwin was doing, like the seed dispersal and the fantastic buzzing place story, which we've had a lot of fun with. So that's another kind of moment, which is great, because then we've got an indoors and outdoors, which is perfect for the English weather. but it's really a chance to kind of, yeah, look at how Darwin was using his garden to further his understanding of his theory.
So what was this thinking behind the way you've presented the story to visitors? Because obviously you've chosen some highlights, but he did lots of experiments, didn't he, in the garden? So it must have been quite difficult to choose which ones you were going to explain to the layperson.
It was. I mean, Emily and I have been working on this project for, I think, 2 years, and we've discussing which were the best stories to present to visitors that were, as Emily was saying, they're sort of deceptively simple, but actually quite hard to explain succinctly in a way that is really fun and engaging. So we had to kind of think about whether they were stories that would come across in a way that was accessible, but also that covered all the tenets that Darwin was kind of looking at through his theory. And so we had to, like, to ensure that we had a good cross-section of what he was trying to understand. But we're also thinking about our audience and families, any age groups from, you know, a baby in a sling to a grandma. And so we were looking at how to present the stories in a way that would engage in sort of engender a conversation between the age groups. So we've tried to pitch it across all of those.
And I think the most fascinating idea really is that out of an English country garden came this world science. It's quite remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm really wanting to encourage visitors to go back and look at the outside in a different way. And some of the stuff that they were up to is just so bonkers and fun, that, like, playing a bassoon to a worm to see if they could hear, and things that, you know, just you could do for fun in your own garden or in your own park, just to engage with nature in a way that kind of makes you see the world differently. And that's something that we can do. And we're doing a series of training sessions with our volunteers to sort of get them to really help spark the conversation between visitors and help them look at the space a bit differently and give them a really warm welcome as families. We really want to kind of encourage that playfulness and conversation in our garden.
Childlike curiosity is quite,
that's
quite
right,
a key theme, I suppose, isn't it?
Really? Yeah, yeah. And that really comes across as in Darwin's, yeah, insatiable curiosity really does come across in his experiments.
I suppose the last thing that people want to know is, when can they see these new interactive displays in the garden?
Yeah, you can go down to the gardens and see them now. They're there to enjoy.
Okay, lovely. This has taken a while to come to fruition as a project. You mentioned it taking a couple of years. It's quite a short amount of time in a way for you to work on it when you compare the amount of work that Darwin did, which was pretty much a lifetime. Are you ever sort of astounded by his body of work and the massive difference that he made to the world's understanding of the natural world?
I mean, yeah, who wouldn't be failed to kind of be astounded by that? And I think the tenacity of keeping going and the length of time and the revisiting of going back over and over again. We do have to dig deep in this, but yeah, nothing comparable.
What do you think the big takeaway will be for families and visitors now that these new interactive displays are installed? Do you think they'll come away with a more comprehensive understanding and appreciation of Darwin and Downhouse?
I really think they will, actually, because when you visit the house and you go inside, you're getting the story of the beagle and his kind of life's work and the controversy and his kind of feelings about that. And then you're also seeing the domestic house and seeing how he and his family lived. But this is really about the nuts and bolts of his work and the kind of macro and micros kind of scale of it, of the tiny experiments that he's doing about tiny, tiny plants that he then extrapolated into this huge theory that changed our world. And it's a chance to really understand his practical approach to this theoretical body of work. In some ways, you're seeing his thinking in the garden, and we're getting a chance to really explain that. It hasn't happened at Down before. So we really hope that the takeaway for visitors will be that he was developing conceptual ideas using practical experiments in a domestic garden, using the things that we all know about, like a worm or a primrose, using those small things for a big idea.
Out of little acorns, I think, isn't it,
Emily? Indeed.
Yeah, I think so. And I think Nadine's right. I think what we're trying to get an idea of is that it's a very domestic setting, which was a sort of the home for some very big ideas. And I think that's the kind of takeaway message, is that through practical experiments and meticulous observation, Darwin was able to create something which we still talk about in such detail today.
You've been listening to the English Heritage Podcast. Next week, we'll be back in Britannia, unearthing the rich history of Richborough Roman Fort.
This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. We hope that this excavation will provide us with some new data and some exciting stories to tell about how Richborough developed in the Roman period.
Thanks for listening. See you next time.